This is Akafe. Laura Marie and Jessica Marie proudly present A Court of Fandoms and Exploration, a podcast. Fair warning, everything the hosts say is explicit, full of spoilers and adult content, and shall not be used against them. They have opinions. Let's try not to drag anyone for expressing themselves and just have fun for an hour. We all deserve it.
This episode does not contain spoilers, but does mention Skulls, Fearless, the Dark Artifices, and the Magicians. For full list, please see show notes. There's also discussion surrounding sex work, substance abuse, and sexual assault.
And welcome to A Court of Fandoms and Exploration, your weekly deep dive into the YA literature and fandoms that we love. I'm Laura Marie.
And I'm Jessica Marie.
And today we are discussing Ninth House by Leigh Bardugo. And Jessica Marie, what was your first exposure to like secret societies?
Oh my goodness. There was a book that I read many, many moons ago. And I want to say, I don't want to say it's contemporary romance. It's more.
Wait, you said that very
I know. Weird. It's so fucking weird. I don't know where that came from.
That was great. We're keeping that in. Excellent.
Anyway, it was contemporary. It was more plot with romance. And it was like from this, it was called The Secret Society Girl. It was from Tap and Gown series by Diana Peter Freund, P-E-T-E-R-F-R-E-U-N-D. And that sucked me in. And it was specific. It wasn't just secret society. It was specific to Yale secret society. So, however, this book real quick, it just felt like a secret society. Our secret society is just the worst kept secret that everybody knows about and everybody talks about. What was your first one?
The first one that I can like actively remember is you're going to laugh. It's Skulls, the movie with Joshua Jackson.
Yes!
I still have my ticket stub. It came out in 2000. I have my ticket stub and my ticket stub box.
Oh, I completely forgot about that movie. How?
Right?
I don't know.
It's a fucking banger. That movie, Teaching Miss Tingle, like all of those early 2000s, like CW movies. Yeah.
In this one, right?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So this one, obviously it's called Skulls. It's Yale, Skull and Bones. You know, it's on the rowing team, you know, all that stuff. But that was my first exposure to secret societies. My next question to you, Jess, is how did you like this as a dark academia situation? Because you have not had a lot of exposure to that genre. And this book is a book that kind of crosses a lot of different genres.
Yeah, I've read this once all the way through and then another one 90% through at 2.5 speed. So we were like flying through that today as a refresher. I liked it more the second time because I understood it a little bit better. We both read this as an audiobook. That being said, I think there was a lot of confusion to kind of get your hand, you know, get a handling on where you were with the timeline, when there were flashbacks. I think that could, if you aren't familiar with audiobooks or if you're learning, it is, you know, it is a skill. You can't just like mindlessly listen to it as you can with some readings. And I think if you try to use this as a jumping point, this could easily turn a reader off. And it made me wonder if we had read it physically, if some of the flashbacks or like things that were in the, some of the flashbacks would have been italicized. Laura, you had to explain to me a little bit and for me to realize, you know, they talked about seasons, but then where we were on, you know, if we mapped out a timeline, what last, you know, we started with a last fall situation and then we kept current. But it helped knowing when we had a male narrator, we were in Darlington's POV, which automatically helped me, especially the second time, realize, okay, this is, we're in the past now. This is something else that's already happened.
Yes. So many excellent points that you bring up. This book is so confusing. It is confusing. And I know that people don't like this book. I like this book, but there's like caveats to that and I'll get into it. But I have read this now, I'm going to say like 3.5 times. And it is just now after this like half time where I'm writing down just like these random connections that I'm making that I'm actually like actively enjoying the book. And that is too many times through for someone to have. It's too much work. It's too much work to enjoy a book that should be enjoyable the first time through. So, you know, we'll get into like why and how and all of that. But the audio is tricky. And the only way that I was able to really kind of hammer in the distinctions was to look at, like, physically look at the chapters in Audible to like make sure that I was like where I was supposed to be. Because it's hard. It's just not an easy book.
I read this through Libby. In the Audible, does it say chapter 29 fall? Like, does it give you? Oh, the Libby. Okay, I went through the library and all it says is like chapter 29. It doesn't tell me. So that is another thing. Oh, that's so interesting. So that, okay.
I'm going to send Jess through our like regular chat a screenshot of the chapters. We could like include this like so you could easily see. That's what it looks like.
Oh, and I just returned my book, so I don't have the screenshot. But no, this is it. Mine would just say like where it says one, it's a chapter one, chapter 29. I didn't have the winter, last fall, winter, last. This makes such a difference and would have helped me with my audiobook experience.
And this just goes back to what we have said in previous episodes. I'm thinking specifically our Fearless episode, how the formatting of the book did not the formatting of the book did not match the physical book. So the ebook didn't match the physical book. And now this is a difference between the library and Audible.
Yeah. And Fearless, you read physical and I did both the audio and the ebook. And that formatting was completely different from the experience that you had gained from it.
Yes. And something that is very interesting is at the end of the Audible version of Ninth House, there is a 25-minute, 43-second interview with Leigh Bardugo included. It says like okay. Interview with the author. So there's just a lot going on in the audiobook. So Jess, that is really important to highlight. Because if you are using the library and the formatting is different than here, then you're going to be doubly confused as to what the fuck is going on.
Which is like why I said when I did the second reread, I was like, at least I had a better understanding and, you know, picking up on context clues from the first time around. But I go back to saying, if you're still like a novice audiobook user, I would not start off with this unless you're just like, you know, I'm just a dummy and I don't pick up on things really quick. I had to take the FCAT twice.
No, you are not a dummy.
I'm a stress tester. What can I say? I don't pass anything the first time.
I think this just goes to show that like you, in this reading experience, we're not working with all of the information. Like you were not working with all of the given information. So how could you make those like logic? They're not logical jumps to make.
I have a question because I did have this at the end of my audiobook, right? Like after the end, all of that. There's a section about like they go through the houses of the mm-hmm. Veil. Did you have that in yours?
Yes.
Why is that kind of like, you know how when audiobooks and I'm sorry, we're kind of going on a tangent, but not really. Is that something you had it in your copy, but why would that be at the end? Is it kind of like how sometimes when people have phonetic pronunciations of the names, they're at the end and you're like, well, this would have been really helpful at the beginning before going into the book.
I think in this case, they're at the end because if they were at the beginning, it'd be like a super dead giveaway about what everything is about, maybe. Instead of like, because that is all information that you learn gradually, like as the book goes, like,
and it carries the story as she's like discovering the certain house. So I do get that.
And how I think of it as is that information is part of like the index of the life of Lethe that she is like reading and like quoting and like thinking about and like, you know, is talked about throughout the whole book. So that's kind of how I think about that as well. Ugh. Speaking of the life of Lethe, Jess, do you want to talk about the book now? Who are these people?
We have a lot of people, but we'll highlight some of the mains. We have Galaxy Alex Stern. She's a freshman at Yale. She's a Dante. So she's basically going to be taking on this role that will kind of like help oversee all the other secret societies. There's 8 in total. The 9th, you can say, is Lethe. Lethe is the babysitter of, you know, kind of like supposed to be a checks and balances of everybody. Alex didn't graduate high school, but she can see ghosts in the book. They're known as grays. They're called grays because everybody can see them in like grayscale, black and white. However, she can see grays in color. So Alex is from LA. She has had her experience with like toxic relationships, toxic boyfriends. She's had like some substance abuse issues. And when Yale found out, the secret societies found out that she had this power to see grays without having to take, you know, the special elixirs that, you know, they typically do at Lethe House, it was like, hey, you want to get out of this situation and we'll give you a full ride. Like at Yale, even though you did not graduate, you don't even have your GED, but here, we're going to give you all the resources. Then you have Darlington, who was a Dante. He's a senior now. He's known as... what is he known as?
The Gentleman of Lethe.
Yeah, Gentleman of Lethe. He's basically like HBIC, and he's having this peer mentor relationship with Alex because he's like, look, you're going to be in this position at one point, probably your senior year. Here, we're going to give you all the information. You have Dawes, who is an oculist. She's charged with like maintaining like the safe houses. She's also kind of like, I want to say like not a doctor, but she's kind of a caretaker in some sort of way. She's also a research assistant at Yale. You have Turner, who's a detective. He's also kind of like the liaison between the local police department and the secret societies. You have Sandow, who's the dean of Lethe House. You have a gray known as Bridegroom. He's helped save Alex in certain situations. He's also known as North. But he has kind of this stigma about him because the lore is he was part of like a murder-suicide situation. So he, so people are like, look, he's like a bad spirit. He's a bad gray. You really don't want to build relationships with grays at all, let alone a negative spirit. You also have Bellbaum, who is another dean, kind of oversees women's studies at the, at Yale, but come to find out, and we'll go into it because if you're listening to this episode, spoiler alert, she is Bridegroom's bride. So, whoa, how we get there, we'll discuss. Then you have Tara Hutchins, who is the local town girl who was found dead, and she's kind of where the whole murder mystery starts kind of kicking off of like where we get to in the story. And then you have some characters like Mercy, who is Alex's roommate at Yale. You have like boys from lacrosse, Trip and Blake. And then you have a couple people from her LA life, Helly and Len, her best friend at the time and her ex-boyfriend. But they are referenced to a lot in her past because like with all main characters, your past helps, you know, get you to where you are in your present.
Yes. Gosh, there's so much going on.
And they're all important. They're not just like, oh, and here's this person, here's that person. Like they're all pretty integral in moving the story along.
Yes, they really are. And then we have the ancient 8 houses. Tell me about them.
So we have our 8 houses of the Veil. You have Skull and Bones. We can go through the years, but like the years are also pretty important because they help, you know, discuss what the nexuses are. You have Skull and Bones. It's the oldest society. It's probably also like the most popular one that people hear openly about as well. They specialize in divination, and you have Scrolling Key, established in 1842. They specialize in like projection and portal magic. Book and Snake, which is 1863. They specialize in necromancy. You have Wolf's Head, established in 1883, shapeshifting into animals. Their specialty really lends itself to like animal espionage. So like think of when you say like to be a fly on that wall, and then you could shapeshift into a fly on that wall. Like, that's their shit. I don't know if I'm saying it right. Aurelian, they specialize in like word binding and divination also, like binding unbreakable contracts. You have St. Elmo's, who is elemental magic. They don't have like a tomb, for their society. So they're basically kind of like off the radar. Same thing with Berzelius, which was established in 1843 or 1848. Then you have Manuscript, which was the youngest of the societies. They were established in 1952, and their focus is more mirror magic, illusions, and glamours. They can manipulate perception. That's a lot. Sorry.
Woo. Those are like the main things. And then it's set in New Haven, and it's set at Yale. And New Haven is a town that I have driven through several times on 95 to get up to visit a friend of show that used to live in Rhode Island. So we'd have to take that. And Jess, you and I have made that drive. And You want to get through New Haven at a certain time. Otherwise, you're like fucking stuck in traffic. It's awful. It sucks.
It's one of those drives that you want to... Especially when you're on 95 and you go over that bridge, you look over and you see campus. All you want to do is be like, let's do a quick pit stop.
Yeah, yeah.
But because of the timing situation, you know, if you're making good time, you just keep flying. Like, yeah. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200.
Yeah, do not.
Just get through there.
Yeah. If you have if it is totally clear, you just keep going, because if you get stuck there, you will be stuck for so long.
It's a domino effect, because then the rest of your trip you're backed up.
Yeah.
No matter which direction, north or south.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, yeah, you're either going like north or you're going to like New York, and it's just terrible. It's just a terrible little situation, and it's a very trafficy area. So that being said, I've never been to the Yale campus. I would like to go.
I always want to do a day trip. It's like 2 hours away, and yeah. I still can't bring myself to it because of the traffic.
Because it's terrible. I do want to talk about, a lot of people don't like this book, and Jesse sent me a very good like YouTube video kind of explaining, like, very in broad strokes, like kind of why people wouldn't like this book. And it is an urban fantasy book. And we talked earlier about it being like spanning a couple different genres. And the video that you showed me pointed out that like urban fantasy kind of does, for the most part, like focus on a place, and it like makes you build connections with a place. And I do feel that in the book, The Ninth House, that I have read now like 3.5 times, I am more connected to New Haven and Yale. I feel like Darlington. I'm very connected to like New Haven and what is going on there, and like the connections between everything and the societies, than I am with any of the characters, besides maybe like, I like Dawes, and like, it's taken me this long to really like appreciate Alex. I was really just like neutral on this whole thing for so long.
I think neutral's the perfect word. I mean, it's like I said, it's not bad, but I'm not like, oh my God, I'm not jumping for a reread.
Yeah.
I love that you've been able to make that connection, because sometimes, would you consider The Dark Artifices urban fantasy? Because
I guess,
there is a place, if we're going with that.
Yeah, I guess maybe technically, yeah.
There's also the correlation of the magicians that video had brought up too.
And of course, we absolutely love the magicians. We love the magicians so much. And just before we start get into this book, and we promise we will, I mentioned earlier that it has taken me this long, 3.5 reads, to like really appreciate and understand and like this book. And that is like too long, and it's just like too much work. But I will say that I have picked up on a lot of different things, and I have kind of enjoyed finding things, because I don't connect to Leigh Bardugo's books. And I feel like every time I read them, I'm missing something. I am missing the thread to connect me to the thing that everybody really loves. So in this one, I'm really trying to like, I'm trying to find it, right? Because all her other books have not hooked me. And this one still hasn't hooked me, but I appreciate it more than the other ones.
Do you think it's because it's adult?
I think it is because I like adults doing magic in magic places, and I like the potential of like I could still do it. Like Dean Sandow's old and he's still doing magic. Like it could still happen for me, right? Like I like that potential. And that is why I like the magicians, because they are older. They're doing magic. It could still happen. So I do like and appreciate that. And there isn't a lot of magic school kind of stuff like that for adults. So I do like this for that as well. Because a lot of it is just magic boarding school for kids.
That's what I was going to, because I was thinking of the Black Witch, because that was really my first magic school outside of Harry Potter. But that, even though that's skewed YA, this is not skewed YA in any capacity. And that wasn't the, from what I had read, that wasn't even the intention that Leigh Bardugo had with this. It just kind of went in that direction as she was writing, because she was like, I knew this story had to be told. But for some people, like, how do you, you know, depending on the direction of the story, how it's going to go, how do you tell a college story for YA?
Well, how do you tell this story at all? This story is broken up, as we said, into like three separate pieces. It's I'm not even going to talk about where it starts. OK, so we have last fall, and last fall is narrated by a male narrator, and that is Darlington, and that is the past. And then we have winter, which is like our present day. And then we have early spring, which starts off as our future, but ends up, you know, being our present day. And that, you know, we connect in full circle with early spring, because this book cold opens with Alex in the hutch. And we kind of get her explaining Yale and Lethe House through her reading this pamphlet, Life at Lethe, and kind of like, you know, everything. But this is after she has been attacked by the jackals, you know, at Il Bastone. And it was just like, I understand the storytelling technique, and I understand this cold open, and it's supposed to like really pull us in and everything. But this cold open with Alex, you know, and then going right into winter, going right into the prognostication, I was just like, what the fuck is going on? Like,
at what point in this book did you, if like that's how, like, you know, cold opens tip are supposed to be the hook. At what point in this book did you really feel like, okay, now we're in it? Or did it take you the third read to be like, okay, now I'm in it?
The entire first read, I was completely neutral. I finished it and I was like, what is this? And then that was like right when it came out in 2019. And then I read this again over Thanksgiving week and I was like, okay, because I remembered who the villains were. I remembered the plot. So then I was reading it knowing who the villains were. So then I was in it.
Yeah, because then you're focusing on like everything that, but I'll tell you what, they really do throw you off, because even in the second read, like with Dean Sandow, I was like, I could easily see why I would have been thrown off. Like, I wasn't like a, it's all right there. I was like, I'm still like, huh, if I didn't know, I would have been dissuaded to a different thing.
Oh, absolutely. So, and this is a murder mystery. Like, Alex has to solve a murder. You know, after the cold open, it's winter, and Alex is at the prognostication, and she ends, you know, she has to go figure out that Tara is murdered. But if you put this, if you laid this book out flat and rearranged it and put it in linear chronological order, the first person that Alex interacts with from Yale, from Lethe, because this is a murder mystery, so that person is going to be our villain. The first person that she interacts with is Dean Sandow. So that tracks in your typical murder mystery procedural. They all follow the same pattern. You just have to look for it. It's the first person that you interact with after. But like this is that. The second in the book, The first in the book, but the second chronologically, if you're looking at Yale adult figures that could be murderers, is Turner. And then the third is Bellbaum. So like Turner's our red herring and then Bellbaum would be the third. And that follows the procedural as well. It's just very interesting. So yeah, the second reread, I was just like, well, damn. Which is good because it's just confusing as fuck. So I think for us, the easiest thing would just be to like, let's go through her life, Alex Galaxy.
Great name.
I'm glad you said that because...
Oh, you hate it.
I like it. Do you know why Galaxy's mom calls her her little star?
No.
Because Stern is German for star.
Oh,
right?
That's so cute.
Yep. I Google translated it just to confirm because my German is... sehr schlecht. But yeah, I'm right. So yeah,
that's so fun.
That's why it's just a little thing.
I love that.
Yes. But do you want, let's go through her life in LA. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's see. I mean, she started seeing Grays in grade school and people thought she was crazy and it affected how she did things. You know, she went on in, you know, trigger warning, sexual assault. She was sexually assaulted by a Gray at 11 years old in a field trip bathroom. And then she's, you know, she kind of, you know, toward, and of course she had shitty fucking friends who like made a whole rumor about her because she's like, oh, she started her period or something, made her middle school years a living hell. She finally gets with like the quote unquote cool kids. There is introduction to, I think, weed, something like super low key. And then she starts self-medicating, figuring out what drugs would help her not see these Grays, to not be in the headspace because of her trauma that happened on this field trip. So she eventually does have a substance abuse problem and she kind of like she drops out of school. She has like a toxic boyfriend. She has a good, you know, girlfriend relationship who winds up ODing. Right. Yeah.
Helly. Yeah.
So Helly ODs and she was there the whole time, you know, holding her best friend. And then, of course, the toxic boyfriend's like, crap, like he's not even thinking about it. All Alex wants to do is call the cops. And he's like, you can't do that. You're so stupid, blah, blah, blah. And then like she kills him. She kills the people, her ex and somebody else, I think. She wakes up in a hospital. She doesn't basically recount any of the information right away. And that's where we meet Dean Sandow saying, hey, we have this offer. We know you can do certain things. We could use that here at Yale. And she pieces out. She's like, you know what? And honestly, Laura and I, we talked before the episode started. We would have made the same decision too. Like get, you know, remove herself from the situation. And even in, when she does go to Yale, like she has really great roommates, like they're helping her like study. She's going to the tutor center. Like the resources are there and she's constantly acknowledging the lack, like, you know, that there is privilege, you know, and even acknowledges her own privilege for this situation, even though her circumstances weren't that way.
Yes. 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 So all of that information that Jess just told us is sprinkled in throughout this whole book. All of that is revealed to us. And adding on to that, Helly, Alex's best friend who ODs, becomes a ghost and waits for Alex to wake up. And Alex, like, doesn't let her go and says, like, stay with me, stay with me. And Helly goes into Alex. And through that possession, Helly inside of her, using her left hand, because Helly is left-handed, is able to murder Alex's boyfriend, Len, his best friend, I don't remember his name, Extra, maybe? I'm not sure. The villain... Alton, I think his name, and then two other guys in that house. She murders all of them. And then Helly like directs her into like the reservoir to like wash everything away and then go back so that there is absolutely no suspicion on Alex, that Alex could not have done any of that. Number one, Alex is right-handed. And number two, she was too skinny and she was wet and completely clean. And there was no blood washed in any of the sinks or drains or anything. And that is also revealed to us throughout the course of the whole book through Darlington's flashbacks and through Alex's flashbacks. And it is hella confusing. It's hella confusing.
And it's because of Darlington's flashbacks, because he has that connection with her through, I don't want to say the Merity. Was it the Merity? He was like that. He infiltrated her thoughts more or less at one point, and that's kind of how he absorbed. Like, he's like, oh, this is more than I was expecting to when connecting with Alex.
Yeah, he was like looking at her and he was like, I can see that this is not right. Like, yeah, he absolutely did make the connection. And he made that connection that she had killed all of those people by letting in a gray right, like, moments before he got sucked in to the mouth of the Hell Beast. You know, spoiler, I guess. But, like, that. So, like, that whole situation. So it was just, it's all very confusing. And then I think we should say that Alex is brown. She sees herself as like brown. She calls herself brown. And her mother does not know her father and says only that he is brown and a Gemini and loves the ocean. And she does not know him at all, except that her grandmother, Alex's grandmother, who was Jewish, said that he was no good. And that the father took one look at the grandmother and ran away and never came back, which is very interesting. And then when Alex is afraid at her first kind of ritual, the inspiration ritual, and she falls down when the grays touch her, she starts singing her grandmother's song, which is a mix of Spanish and Hebrew, which is the, I wrote it down, it's the language of the... like diaspora, it's the language of death. So I'm bringing this up because I have noticed these things in all my reads, and I swear to God, that'll be important. Calling it.
But I mean, it is. It's all necessary, and it's such a specific detail that even
like,
though...
Why is it there?
Yeah, why is it there? I mean, granted, we kind of get a glimpse of it here, but it's only a glimpse to be like, huh, how did she know that? And she was like, oh, it's my grandma's song. Like, I don't know. But that, you know, knowing that Libra Digo has mentioned, I think on Twitter, that this is a 5+ book series and that we're getting Hellbent, you know, January 2023, I'm sorry. That who knows how that will factor in for the next book.
Yes. Yes. Okay. So that is all of Alex's life in LA. So I think we can just like leave that as that. She was sexually assaulted by a gray, and quite rightly, it fucked up the entire trajectory of her life. And she is angry about that, as she has every single right to be, and does tell Darlington, not about that, but about like being angry because she was being watched this whole time. And like monitored by Yale and Lethe, and they did not do anything to help her because they did not like look deeply enough into her situation to realize that like it was more than just she can see grays. They can like touch her. And all she wanted was like words to get rid of them.
Yeah. And we don't realize the touching part of it till that flashback, because when her and Darlington are doing that training in the, you know, one of the flat, there's like flashbacks to the flashbacks, I'm telling you. And that's when they're like, what do you mean you got pushed down? What do you mean you were being attacked? They can't do that. And she's like, they can with me.
Yes, they can with me. Which is a good way to open, because the book opens, I guess, at the Skull and Bones prognostication. And this is our present day. And the second reread, did you realize that was Darlington knocking and trying to come in?
No, not till now.
Yeah.
I'm just proud I could say prognostication now. That was my only, that was my takeaway from reading the second book.
So it's the, so as I say, opens with the prognostication with Skull and Bones. The grays are gripping the wood so hard, screaming, trying to get into the protection circle because something is knocking on the barrier, trying to get in. And it's something so big.
And it's him as the hell beast.
Yeah, it's him as a hell beast trying to get in.
And he's trying to get, like, he's, I don't think he's bad. I think he, like, I know they're saying, like, he's demon or whatever.
He's I don't think he's bad either.
I don't think he's bad.
No. Yeah, I think he's trying to get to Alex, and that was, like, a power draw. He knew that she'd be there, so he's like...
Well, they say something else, and I forgot to fucking highlight it. I'm sorry. Where it was that loophole. It was, like, something that was said that reading it, it could be glanced over. I go, no. They just glanced over them. It was before he got sucked in. It was when they were talking about, like, wait, I don't think he's with us anymore. That section when they were putting all the pieces together that he's not in this limbo, but they never said he wasn't in the limbo. I go, he's not a gray. He's in this limbo and nobody's addressing it. And it's loosely addressed at the end. I mean, we know where he is. We know he's been sucked in. I go, but that doesn't mean he was eaten. I don't think, like, I think he went to the other side and is fucking shit up.
Yeah,
maybe I'm like a little early. That should have been how we ended the episode. Sorry.
But, like, it's just so, like, but I think this just goes to, like, you have to put the work in to really appreciate this book, because this is the, like, second, like, first chapter, because the first, like, the opening is the prologue. This is the first chapter and it's our present day, and Darlington is knocking, trying to get in, and the Greys are so afraid of him, the gentleman demon, that they are trying to get in.
He's like, oh, you know what that gives me? It gives me, like, Elijah Michelson feels.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, so very fun, very fun, very exciting. So at the same time that this prognostication is happening that Alex has to do on her own because Darlington has disappeared, the murder of Tara by Dean Sandow is also happening. Old man Dean Sandow, who is in debt and is being blackmailed at this point by St. Elmo's to create a nexus of power. And he's murdering Tara to... like, pay up.
Okay, so the nexus, what would you say is, like, what it is? Like, it's kind of like a power source slash, I don't want to say it's a portal, but that's the, okay, so here's the significance with the years of the societies being established, is they were in direct correlation with a nexus happening in that year. What would you say, like, what is a nexus? Like, I know, like, when we're referencing, but I'm like, what is it in the most basic, simple term? It feels like a power surge of some sort.
So they describe Yale as having rivers of power that flow through the city. And a nexus is an eddying of that power. So it's like a branch of the river that kind of forms into, like, a little puddle kind of situation. And that is what the societies are built on. Now, the question is, what made those little eddies and those puddles from the river of power? Because that didn't, like, naturally occur. And what made those is the pull from when Bellbaum ate the fucking souls of those girls.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I knew that part. And I was like, how would you, like, but, and that's how we realize eating the souls, because she wasn't eating the souls immediately. She was doing them in quick succession. So that's why you have, like, the societies, because the societies were created, like we had just said, the societies were created during the year, like during the time a nexus was established. And at first they were really quick because she was only consuming quote unquote mortal souls.
Yep.
And then she realized when she consumed a soul who had the same power as Alex, which was seeing Grace, she could go longer in her life without having to eat souls. So that's why you had that huge gap from, like, 1 year to, like, 1953, because that between that time frame, the most recent soul that she had eaten had been, like, a wheel walker. Thank you. And that's what the people who can see Greys are known as, are wheel walkers. So Alex was supposed to be the next soul that she was going to consume. And Dean Sandow knew this too. He was like, you were supposed to be fucking dead. Now I had to create a bunch of, you know, stories. What's the thing? Like, what a tangled web we weave when we learn to deceive. Like, he was like, I gotta pull all this shit out of the air.
Yeah. So, like, okay. So let's just like go through the plot before we go through the details. So what is happening? So, okay. The societies are fluctuating in power, and it's a funding year for Lethe. Okay. Dean Sandow is in debt with a bad divorce. Okay. He's being blackmailed by St. Elmo's at this point because he made a deal with them, and he made a ritual to create a nexus because he used to be really good at Lethe, and it didn't work because he didn't understand that you need to, like, eat souls, because why would you... He just thought you needed to murder people.
Which is the quote unquote nexus he thought he was creating was like him killing Tara.
Yeah. And it didn't work. And he's all pissed off about it.
How about that?
The man's plan, the white man's plan didn't work. He's all pissed off about it and taking it out on everybody. Alex finds Tara's body. She's alerted by Oculus after the prognostication, which is her first without Darlington. And she's very afraid because the Greys have never acted like that, because Darlington's never knocked on the door before. So everything's freaking out. But it is through Alex's investigation and like tenacity of sticking to the case of Tara that everything else seems to unravel, even though everything else is like pulling her away from Tara. And I do appreciate that. And I want to bring this up because one of the themes of this book, and throughout these rereads, I kind of came up with a couple, but one of them is like hunger. They talk about Alex constantly like being hungry. And like her bones are she looks hungry. Her bones are hungry. She always has food, and her backpack is like a security blanket, and like hot food always available is something that she'll never get used to. But her hunger that way is directly related to Bellbaum, and how when Bellbaum was trying to eat Alex, Bellbaum's soul was like teeth. And, she was always hungry, and she had to eat to, like, sustain herself. And then in the very beginning, when we meet Bellbaum in her office for the first time, Bellbaum says, like, Alex, what do you want? Like, you're hungry. I respect hunger. These other people haven't had to work like you and I have. And she's like, she kind of, like, starts grooming her a little bit, a little bit there, because she does want her to, like, ripen so she can eat her.
Yeah. And I mean, I didn't even think I thought you were going to say that, like, there was a hunger for knowledge. That's where her ambition comes from, because she's kind of, I don't want to say ambition, like, scholastically, but she's like, I think a lot of it stems from, you know, she kind of had to run. I don't want to say ran away from home, but her mom was trying to lock her up. And she was like, I can't do this. Nobody believes about this. Her basically being a wheel walker. And so she runs away, and she's had, obviously the food is a security blanket because she's had to live on the streets. So she said if she ever got kicked out of Yale, she knew she couldn't at least survive for a couple days. And then there was also the fact, like, the hunger to figure out what the hell is happening with Tara, because Tara is also, I feel, in a way symbolic to like how she kind of saw herself back in LA. People, and this goes back to her acknowledging, like, I'm at these secret societies who are all part of Fortune 500s, who are all part of these inside gigs. Like, I'm just a regular person who nobody here realizes that I don't even have my GED. So I'm very fortunate to be here. And I would be dismissed if I was amongst any other group of people. And that's one of the things where she and her roommate, they always feel like they have an even playing ground, because all of that past from LA, even though it isn't carried with her to Yale, internally it is. So I feel like she's trying to fight for justice for Tara, because in a way it's also like Helly.
You bring up such a great point. You're talking about internally. Let's talk about Alex externally, because I have a practical issue with her tattoos.
The ones that she got like disappeared?
Yeah, yeah. So like I understand her tattoos going into the moth and Darlington doing that for her, and like recognizing that she was uncomfortable and all of that throughout her tour. I understand that. And I like Darlington and Alex's relationship. My issue is like I don't have tattoos. I am a giant weenie, but I know that they are not cheap. I know this. I know that they are not cheap. So for Alex to have like what, two full sleeves and clavicles, right? Like,
I feel like you can argue that though, because she even talks about the time where she was like kind of being a runner for the ex-boyfriend and she didn't accept all the money. She's like, yeah, we'll get it back. She trusted him. And then she talks about like different act, you know, she was like a, you know, she was a sex worker here and there. So I feel like you can, are, you know, people, you like, people do like sex work for, you know, I want a sleeve, I wanted this, or it could be like, hey, I really want a sleeve, or I really wanted this. And then somebody could be like, okay, but it's going to cost you. And it might not necessarily be through monetary means.
This is my point. It is never addressed. Like,
oh, this is what you're saying. You're like, yeah, it's not, you're like, okay.
It's never addressed. It's never addressed. So like we're just supposed to like, I just don't understand, because they do talk about like going to the tattoo parlor and like getting the tarot like tattooed and like all of this stuff. And it's just like, okay, you throw in a little payment here. You're throwing in a little, you know, unnecessary details about other things. But like, I know.
If it doesn't add to the story kind of thing.
Yeah. It's like, I know that these are really expensive, wow, like really expensive. And then also, they seem very beautiful. And I have not seen, I guess, a lot of fan art. Also, honestly, this is on me. I haven't really looked, but I haven't seen a lot of fan art too. And I think they would be very lovely. Also, the fact that at the end of the book, she puts the tattoos back on is in a full circle, you know, accepting moment of herself, is also very lovely. But I don't know. It was just, this part, this tattoos part is an example that I'm giving of, I know that there is something more here. I know that there is more here. Because why mention it so many times? Like, I they're on, they're off, they're here, they're there. I could put them on other people, but they might not quite fit. All of this, I know that,
and
there's
other people. You're bringing up a good point, because other people even reference it. Like, oh, I see what Darlington did. I see that he kept, like, I know, especially other people who can see past that, and not veil as in ghosts, but see past the illusion, I guess I can say.
Yeah.
The illusion that the tattoos are being masked. They go, I could see your little tattoos under that whole gimmick you got going on. I see what Darlington did. So, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah. So, like, what is it? It is just another example of, like, I'm not connecting all of the dots in a Leigh Bardugo book. But that could also be that this is the first book. You know, there's going to be four more. And I'm just, like, it's just a big star in my notes with a big, like, explain, please.
And it's like, and also, I don't even want to dwell on it, because we don't know what we don't know.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like, we have already talked about Bellbaum. We've already talked about the first kind of rite that Alex has to do, where she learns that you can banish grays with grave dirt and bone dust and the words, and how she falls. And there's a big wave, like a crashing wave of grays that were coming, which is like very scary. And everybody was really scared, but like it's a whole thing. There's just a lot going on here. I think we should just like skip around a bit. Alex is attacked by a fucking Glooma. I didn't expect that.
No, there was a lot of things that happened that I didn't expect. I mean, visually, you have the New Haven. Sometimes when they were in the graveyard, I'm immediately in Buffy, thinking, yep, Buffy. What is a Glooma? Because a Glooma is like a bad. And Dean Sando sicked him on her.
Yeah. So a Glooma is like a clear ghost, right?
Like the ghost in Mario?
Yes. So it's like that coming at you. But he has been given like one task. And his task was like kill Alex Stern. And like he will do that. Like the Glooma will do that until he can't anymore. Like until like one of them is dead.
Which is where the Gray North, yes, who is the bridegroom, intercedes and protects and not even protects, saves Alex from the Glooma.
Yes, he absolutely saves Alex from the Glooma. And because she has breathed in all of the corpse beetles. So she's like dying. So she like has to crawl her way to the hutch. And in the hutch is where we get Dawes's really fantastic speech to Dean Sandow, where she's like, Dean Sandow, that sounds a lot like you said that she's asking for it.
I loved that scene. And I guess Alex wasn't sure about where she kind of stood with Dawes and like their relationship with each other. And she was even shocked that like Dawes came to my defense. It was such a good scene because Sandow's trying to dance around the whole situation. And we know this now from the end of the book because he's the one who sucked the thing after her.
Yes. Yes. Oh, my God. And Dean Sandow's like, well, you know, we don't know why the great, because like he's trying to cover his ass because Alex is still on the case. She's still working the case. She's gone to the morgue. She's submitted the report. She's doing the background research. She's like trying. She's going to start working with North to figure out what's going on. And Sandow doesn't know how much she knows. So he's like, fucking go kill her. And he's sitting there like, well, your presence here because you can see them is just like throwing everything the fuck off and it's your fault. And like, you know, da 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 da. And after Dawes says that, he's like, that's not what I meant. which is great. Like make him stutter and like splutter a little bit. He's the villain the whole time. But it was a great moment.
I mean, I love how Dawes continues to come through even at the end. I say the end. We get a lot of dumping at the end. We get a 1-2 punch of like a double whammy of who the bad guys are. I say plural because there are. And even before that, you have Dawes going, she had to do all this shit. They're like, well, how can we make it up to you? And same thing. She was like, not only does she have a full ride, she's also going to, you're going to just, she's not failing her classes. Not now, not ever. Which they were like, look, we know like a 4.0 isn't realistic, but like at least a 3.5. And I'd be arguing for like at least a 3.89. But good for Dawes for kind of constantly being like, if she's not going to speak up for herself, I will be her voice for her.
Yes. And during the rereads, Dawes is one of the characters that I ended up liking a lot. You know, I understand being a grad student, just wanting to do your work.
And then like, on top of that, I think there is a ferocity that Dawes has because, again, this comes with the audio experience. They definitely make her keep your head down, keep to yourself, kind of soft-spoken. And I think that just is a testament to everyone is always so used to, like, the loud extroverts being, like, a really strong, powerful person. And there's people kind of write off people who are a little more you know, reserved in how they handle situations. And Dawes, like, shows up for that.
She really does. I love her. I really do. I really love her. We have to talk about the Halloween party. The Halloween party where Darlington gets dosed at Manuscript. And he says, like, he fucking hates going to Manuscript. It's the worst. He hates them all so much.
I love how they talk about it because they really, like, the secret societies are kind of the Greek life of Ivy Leagues. And it's the same things that we were like, oh, the parties here are the worst.
And he's just like, fuck. But this is our introduction to Merity, which is the acolyte drug. And it gives people purple tongues. And this comes into play when Mercy, again, is sexually assaulted on camera by Blake Keeley. And, you know, that's like another part of the plot, which is gross. But after Darlington is drugged, and this is when he sees Alex as like Queen Mab, and because Alex is dressed as Queen Mab, and Queen Mab has like butterflies coming out of her back. And he sees that and he knows that Alex is terrified of butterflies. Of course, Alex was sexually assaulted by the Grey at the butterfly pavilion or whatever, which, you know, it's all there. But he tells Alex that, you know, Queen Mab is like the queen of the night and like the fairy's midwife. And he's like on her legs and like going up her thighs and he wants to like serve and like really serve her. And the person running the rite at the time is like, oh, see, he is an acolyte at heart. He does want to serve at heart. It's just like, because in my head, Darlington is hot.
Well, I mean, yeah. But I also don't imagine not attractive people.
True. This is true. This is true. But I do appreciate Alex in this moment just like being like, Darlington, fuck off. Like, come on. Like, snap out of it. Because she does realize that he is like drugged and that it's a fucked up situation. And Alex does blackmail the fuck out of these people to make sure that not only is the report going to be okay, Darlington's going to be okay. Fuck all y'all. And I'm hanging this over all y'all's head and I'm calling him a favor later.
I love that she applies the rules to the streets to these Ivy League kids. I really do. Like, even though she's like, yeah, I might be attending Ivy League, but like, I'm not one of y'all.
Yes. Yeah. Like, and I do. And it's funny you bring up the Ivy League. They mention that Yale and like New Haven feel like less Ivy than the other Ivies, and that the murder of Tara close to campus just kind of like drives that home. But, you know, I just found that just to be a funny little like dig for no reason. Like, that didn't have to be in there. Okay, we're talking a little bit of shit, but that's fine. Speaking of shit,
I love this transition.
After Blake Keeley and one of his friends grossly sexually assault Mercy on camera, Alex finds out and she's not having it. She goes and she calls in a favor. She's like, fuck you, here's my favor. And she gets star power and she gets them to like control the internet a little bit, which I think is funny, and to get the video taken down. But she takes star power and she goes into the frat house more or less. And she just is just like charming all these guys. And she gets them to delete the videos, gets everything. And then she's
and like, not just Mercy's video, because then she finds out that they have videos of everybody that they've sexually assaulted. Specifically, not just on the Merity drug, because the Merity drug is an FDA approved. It doesn't show up in the systems. It's a magic drug, all this stuff. So they have on video, you're consenting to this, yep. Right? So even though but that's not the case with what's happening because they're on a drug.
Yeah. And that drug makes you want to serve. So like, of course you would say yes. Like, you're honored to say yes. It's just disgusting. There's so many levels of disgusting. But Alex makes Blake Keeley literally scoop shit out of the toilet and like eat it on camera, like with a smile on his face
and on his phone with his contacts. And that's like, we love it.
She's not on camera at all. You can't hear her voice. Like, it's glorious. We love it. We love it. We love it. We love it.
And even when she goes back to her friends, they were like, what did you do? And she's like, what? I didn't do anything. You asked me to handle something. They took the video down. I made sure I don't know what you're talking about. Love it. Here, queen.
Yeah, for real. It's just like, if we're moving on with the plot, I do want to say that Alex feels like she has like a rattlesnake inside of her. And that is like kind of a repeated image that she has. There's like a snake inside of Alex. The snake uncoiled. It reared its head, or she could feel the snake inside of her like rattling.
Snake on the cover.
Yeah. So it's like there's a whole thing. What is going on? There's a whole thing. There's this scene at Tara's apartment where Turner finally like accepts that magic is real. And, you know, Lance is there. There's a whole fucking thing. They find out about the crucible and all of this stuff at the greenhouse. And the plot. We can just unravel the whole plot at the end. But let's talk about Rosenthal Hall, because this is the moment. This is the Darlington disappears moment. This is like the thing, the moment that the whole book is like centered around, right? Like,
it took so long to get here.
And there's still, like, when you look at it, really, there's still so much book left.
I will say, it's 16 hours. So, like, compared to what we've read before, this is nothing. And we also don't read at speed. But it felt like a book that took a while.
It did. And obviously, I'm looking at our timestamp now. This is going to be a long episode. It just is what it is. But if we're talking about Rosenthal Hall, this is St. Elmo's, like, old, like, tomb. And sometimes it just goes haywire and you have to go down there and you have to like use the fuse box and the little weather vane.
Yeah, you're like, oh, let's do a reset.
Yeah, it's like a whole thing. Yeah, it's like a whole thing. And While they are down there, though, there was some dialogue that I found was very interesting. So they're in the basement, right? And we know that Sandow has opened or like summoned the Hell Beast. Like Sandow did that. He summoned the Hell Beast that is there to eat both Darlington and Alex, because Darlington has found the connections by this point to the Nexuses, and he is already on that path. And he can't find that out because he'll just blow it all up. And that's bad.
And he will, because he's like, he's the gentleman, you know, he does everything by the book. He has taken great pride in his role as Dante. He takes great pride in what he does now as a senior. He's very buckled up with everything that he does. So he's not even thinking of the politics that come with the secret societies. He's thinking, we're in Lethe House. We're the voice of reason. We're the ones who keep everybody. And he takes that to heart.
Yeah, we are the knights. We are the shepherds. Like, yeah. So this is so good. So when they are down in the basement, they successfully reset it. But Darlington is aware that there is something over there. He thinks it's a portal. So he starts talking to really distract Alex so that she doesn't panic. And while the basement is humming before they disarm it, Darlington has this image of Alex wreathed in snakes, and he can't shake it. And every time he looks at her, she's just wreathed in snakes. So there you go, Anne.
I just made a connection.
Yes?
The snakes with Medusa. Medusa's also a symbol of sexual assault.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The Nexus of Power, there's a mention of like, yeah, there's just like a lot of them here. Why are there so many? Blah, blah, blah. but Darlington says that there are demons. They talk about demons here. And they say like demons live in like a hellscape behind the veil. And that weirdly, demons are ambidextrous. And that's like one way to tell a demon is that they're ambidextrous. Why put that in if it's not important?
Well, they do also. I mean, granted, this talks about Heli too, is that if you're left-handed, that is the hand of the devil. It's the sinner's hand, and I'm left-handed. And the amount of people that you find out are left-handed, but still we're only 10% of the population, I do not understand.
This is true. This is true. This is all very true. This demon stuff, there is more like demon lore kind of sprinkled out throughout here, which I find very interesting. But Darlington hears the mouth. He goes over there to try to solve it, but he is distracted and upset because he's made the connection now that Alex let a gray inside of her to kill all of those people in LA, and he feels he needs to tell Sandow. And he's trying to reconcile that.
He's just trying to be so righteous about it. And he doesn't even know the whole freaking story.
Yeah, he doesn't know. And he's distracted. And because he's distracted, he doesn't realize till he's too close that it's not a portal. It's a mouth. And he's saying there that he doesn't have anything really to tether him. Like his love for Black Elm and his love for New Haven, like aren't enough to tether him to the area. Like, who would call out for him?
It's like the drop where they say you have to have somebody to tether you to bring you back from the drop.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just, we are up to Lance confessing everything to Turner and Alex. This was a lot. This whole
I feel like I'm blacking out right now. I don't even remember who Lance is.
That's okay. Lance is the boyfriend. Lance is Tara's boyfriend. So he shows up at at Tara's apartment and Turner, all of that. So now they are all there to question Lance and figure out what the fuck is going on. What is the plot? I've got it. Are you ready?
Tell me.
Okay. So Tara sold weed to Dean Sandow's wife when she had cancer.
That's right. They're starting to go into like how Tara was associated with like a bunch of the societies, and they're like, okay, there's a, okay.
So because she did that, and because his wife had cancer, he wasn't careful about what he was saying, he being Sandow. So Tara learned about the secret societies through that. And because of that, she had like a working knowledge. And then she met a friend at the forestry department, and they started growing pot together.
In the greenhouse.
In the greenhouses. And then through the pot selling, they started growing other stuff, and they started to grow Merity. Yes. So they grew Merity with Kate Masters. And Tara and Svetlana grew Merity. And Lance didn't know what it was, and he sold it to Blake.
He sold it to the lacrosse guys because he didn't think of the importance. He didn't feel like it. He tried it. It didn't hit. And he's like, oh, well, I'll still make a buck.
Exactly.
So he sold it.
Exactly. But then Colin, who is the chemistry person who works for Bell Bomb, and Tara and that society, I can't remember which society it is. We'll get there. Okay. So Colin from Scroll and Key and Tara, they use a little crucible and they make mushrooms.
And the crucible is like the little ring
the
dish
little,
that they
yeah,
did.
Yeah, little dish. Yeah. And they make mushroom tabs. And when you take those mushroom tabs, the portals open and you can go. And then they started traveling the world using the portal tabs.
Magic mushrooms.
Yeah, magic mushrooms. Magic mushrooms. And then Blake and Colin knew each other also, like, from lacrosse. That is the backstory of Tara and her association.
Yeah. And how we got to where we are.
Yeah. And how we got to where we are through this drug trade that was happening illegally under the nose of Lethe and everybody to the societies. And then Dean Sandow and Bell Bomb are like the villains that come in and just like take over everything. Oh my God. It's just like such a thing.
Well, we find all this out also because Alex is digging to find out why was Tara murdered, when really none of that had anything to do with anything. It's just because Sandow needed a sacrificial lamb.
Yeah. Sandow needed.
We know all this stuff and we're like, and none of it was a contributing factor.
Yeah. It didn't even matter. We are up now, though, to my favorite scene. And this is the calling of Darlington home scene at Black Elm. I love this. I love this scene so much. This is one of the scenes that I would like to see on screen because this has been bought for something.
Amazon Prime. Yeah. It was announced in 2019 that Amazon Prime bought the rights for Ninth House. Whether they're going to do anything with it, what we know is they currently have the rights.
Yes. So this calling home scene, they're in the ballroom of Black Elm. The circles are drawn. It's Alex and Dawes and Sandow, Michelle, Almondine, Amelia, Josh Zielinski. It's the Hound Dog casting. They are using the contract to Black Elm. The bells are ringing and then the ground starts shaking and like the roof turns into like nothing but black sky. And then there's just a horned hell beast, which is Darlington, but they don't know that yet, looming over them. And he's screaming, "Murderer, murderer." And Alex thinks that he's saying that to her, but he's saying that to Sandow because he knows everything now. Mm-hmm. He can understand what's happening. But I love it.
And she hasn't made the connection yet that Darlington is the beast because she's like, I hear his voice.
Yeah.
I hear his voice. He's calling me the murderer. Like, that's part of the reason where she's like, he's calling me the murderer, because she's hearing him. She's not making the connection that he is the beast.
Yes. Yes. And like, why would she? You know, why would she? It was just like a crazy thing. But again, this is another instance where his soul was devoured. They say like, you're hearing an echo. We summoned an echo because that's a hell beast who devours the soul and no one can survive that. which is just so, so great.
Oh, that's what the line was where they said no one can survive it. And I go, that was my loophole. Yeah. And I go, but he did. Yeah, there were like no yeah, one. And I go, he's something because I'm thinking like he's not anybody though. He's yeah. not just like a regular. That's what made me think, okay, well, he's not just anybody.
Yeah.
So that's why that was my loophole.
Just it's so good, and everyone's screaming and crying and like shaken, and like at this point,
it could be done really well on screen.
It could,
if like, it could either be really cheesy or like
or really good. But Dean Sandow was not a suspect to me at this point. Especially at this point, this is before the Jackals, like, especially at this point. But him like standing in the middle, right? And he's like screaming that spell to like silence the bells. But what he's actually doing is banishing Darlington so that he can never come back. He's like blocked from Black Elm forever. But he's like got sweat pouring off of him, and he's like standing there and the fires of hell are up there with that giant hell beast. I've been like, what the fuck? He didn't do shit. Are you kidding me? Look at what he's doing. He's saving us. I would have been suckered completely. And I was, of course, the first time through. But that's such a great scene. And I love it. But from this scene on, the book just kind of goes off the rails and goes really fast.
I feel like a lot of her book, I mean, we've read 5 for the podcast so far, and it always picks up. I mean, it's that SJM, I'm not saying that it's formulaic to just SJM, but whenever things pick up towards the last 20%, because that's what it felt like. 80, like I saw my mile marker at 80%, and I go, we still have so much more to go. And it's just, you know, now everything is being at 88%. Things were being spoon fed to us. It was, yeah. Here are the houses, here are the years, here's the soul sucking, here are the girls that Bell Bomb, who we mentioned at the top of the episode, is Daisy, who is the bridegroom's wife. Cause he is in love with his wife. He's like, where is she? I mean, that's part of the thing with like the Greys and kind of, I want to say limbo for lack of a better word. They have their souls aren't completely gone. So he's like, I don't have her soul. I can't find it here. And Alex at first is like, maybe she doesn't want to be found. Maybe she doesn't want to see you because you fucking killed her. And he's like, I didn't kill her. I killed her in the sense that I should have protected her and should have been there, like, you know, doing my husbandy duties. But he didn't physically. He knew, because they talk about like the next thing I knew, I was waking up or something. But we find that he was kind of possessed and did the killing her.
It's
similar to like the hell. It's like. It's similar to how Helly went into Alex's body, yes. And shot the guys. That's what happens. The spirit went into North's body and shot the wife and himself.
Yes. Yes. Oh, my God. It's such a mess. We will get to that, though. We will get to that. Let's get to, there's one more big attack before the spoon feeding of the plot that you mentioned. The big attack is when after everyone leaves from the summoning that didn't work, Sandow is like, we're going back to Il Bastone. I'll meet y'all there. Just go. But he actually compelled Blake Keeley to go kill Alex. And, Blake Keeley shows up and tries to fucking stab her.
That's right, because then he's banging at the door, and they were like, Dawes, don't answer the door.
Yeah, but he's using star power, and he's compelled. So Dawes, of course, opens the door. And Blake Keeley's about to stab Alex, and Dean Sandow arrives, like, oh, I was going to go, because he's the one that did it. So he was going to be the one to open it up and find the bodies. And that's what his plan was. But he goes there and he sees that they're still fucking fighting. He's like, oh, shit, what is going on? And
you're supposed to be dead.
Yeah. And then Blake and Sandow start fighting a little bit. And then Alex, through a lot of tussle, calls the spirit hounds, the jackals that were there from beginning. And they fucking bite everybody. They bite everybody. They snap clean through Sandow's femur. And they end up killing Blake and biting the shit out of Alex. And then they end up at the hospital. Oh, and Dawes kills Blake. Dawes is coming in. Like, yeah. She's coming
Dawes
in.
Dawes is good.
Yeah, Dawes kills Blake with the bust. And then there's this, like, I'm going to call it a come to Jesus meeting at the hospital, where Sandow sits there, looks them all in the eye.
Sandow's not dead yet. He just
passed out. But they're all in the hospital, and Sandow looks them in the eye and was like, "This is my fault. I didn't do enough to protect you. I should have been there. You were right all along." The gaslighting by this man.
Yes, that's one of the notes that I have. I was like, the gaslighting.
Mm-hmm. It is disgusting, the gaslighting. But this is where the bargain comes with the GPA. This is where all of that comes from, that Dawes really goes to bat for Alex for. But it is now early spring, and we have full circled the book. We have met with the cold open, and Alex now in early spring is suffering in the hutch. And this is when Mercy calls her mom, and they kind of like dig her out of the hutch so that she gets going. And through a little bit more detective work, Alex figures everything out. And here, because we're running long, I'm sorry. Here is our spoon fed confession from Bellbaum. You want to do it?
No, you can do it. But I mean, the best part is that Sandow is trying to compel her to listen to him. And that's when Bellbaum is like, "What are you talking about?" And then she winks at Alex, and I go, "Oh my gosh.
She knows.
Yeah, she knows, and she's not being compelled, and she's gonna be the, like, go, women.
She's
power.
Gonna help her. They're gonna get together.
This is gonna be so good."
No.
And then that is the not what happens. We get this, I was saying, and I referred to it a few times, the 1-2 punch of not only was it Sandow doing his own fucking thing, but Bellbaum's also doing her own thing, unbeknownst to each other, that she was the one creating the nexuses because she didn't want to die. She was just a vengeful spirit. Like, the first time, she was already kind of like pissed at her husband because she wanted a honeymoon in Paris. And then he was like, "How about we go to Maine?" And she'd be like, "No, I want to go to Paris." And then she was a wheel walker. She unintentionally forced a spirit into her husband. That's that whole thing. But then she was just like that spirit who didn't want to move on. She didn't want to accept that she was, you know, her fate. So she clung on to her maid's soul and body. Her soul kind of went into the maid's body. And then she's kind of been body jumping with her soul. But in order for her soul to sustain, she had to consume other souls.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, and every time she did that, a nexus would appear. Alex says her great thing, where like, "Don't turn this into a feminist manifesto. You, this white woman, have been killing these immigrant brown girls for 100 years. Fuck you, the horse you rode in on, and everybody around you. Go die." And she does.
She does. And it's just one. I wasn't expecting. Were you expecting that?
No. No, I really wasn't. But I was also like, where the fuck is this going? Like,
by the third time that you read everything, did you pick up on some of the obvious things with Bellbaum specifically?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. With the hunger that I mentioned in the beginning.
Yeah.
And then like here, she and Alex describes her soul as having like teeth. And just like the little things. And like Bellbaum isn't mentioned very much. She's in the background of everything. Her salon is in the background of everything. Alex has to go, but you're not really sure of the timeline until Alex is like, "Oh, it's tonight."
Yeah, she's like, "Oh shit, I have to be there." Like, yeah. Now. She was like, "I think it's tomorrow." And
yeah, it's always in the background because you're not supposed to focus a lot on her. So that's what I picked up this time around.
Mm.
Something that I did find interesting is that manuscript is the main secret society that got in trouble here. Manuscript is going to be stripped of their tomb, and St. Elmo's is going to take it. And that's why Sandow was like, "All my debts are paid. Like, I'm good. Like, yeah, we can talk, Alex. Like, it's fine."
Yeah, because his ass is covered. And it's one of the quotes that I actually liked that, and I can't remember. I don't think it was spoken out loud. I think it was just internal dialogue from Alex, where she just, I mean, this is in reference to not just Dean Sandow, but just like the community in which she's involved in right now. And she says, the world might forgive them or ignore them or embrace them, but they will never be punished.
Yes. Yes.
And I mean, holy fuck, like that is accurate still.
That is absolutely accurate still. I'm looking, and we do have to say that Alex is able to defeat Daisy eventually by letting all the Greys around her into herself and like using all of that like power within her.
And it's specifically also she called the spirits of those that Daisy had consumed.
Yes. And the imagery is they peeled out of her like an onion until there was nothing left and she crumbled into like very good imagery. After all of this situation, so like Sandow is dead, Bellbaum is away and gone, you know, quote, no one can find her. Alex can now hear Grace as well as see them, and that's fucking her world up. And she really doesn't want to do that. And she sees Colin, and Colin's really happy to see her. And she's like, what the fuck? And then she realizes that there won't actually be any consequences for everything. And then at Sandow's funeral, they recruit, I believe it's Michelle, to go to hell to go get Darlington. And we have finally finished the book. I feel like I've been talking a lot, and I hope that I haven't. But I have here my last page of notes is a circle kind of situation of things that I picked up on my half reading this morning that I think Odo would just like to share with the class.
Please.
Okay. Little mentions that I mentioned. There is such a thing in Il Baston as perdition water, which is water from the seven rivers of hell. Just a little interesting. The crucible is from Peru, and there are a lot of stolen Peruvian artifacts. And one of the members of Lethe was the inspiration for Indiana Jones. There's two instances of language that I find very visceral. I had like a visceral reaction to, and I find that to be intentional. It was the use of heathen and mongrel. I don't have comfort with those words, and I think that's a good thing. I don't think you should. It was just like weird. And in the context that they were used to get a rise out of the person that was hearing them. So like they were used like, I don't know.
Maliciously.
Yeah, it was just like a eh. One of the things that you asked me about Bellbaum, did I pick it up? Yes. Bellbaum eats souls. So Bellbaum does not scald her tongue on the tea in the very beginning. But Alex takes a sip and immediately sputters because it's too hot. And Bellbaum is able to drink her tea with no problem. Darlington says to Pammy, to Daz, I'd say you're an angel, but you're so much more interesting. And then I like the translated song that Alex sings from her grandmother. The translated lines are, and I think this will mean something. My mother gave birth to me on a dark night and called me the girl without a fortune.
Well, everything you just mentioned, I feel like are going to mean something.
Well, damn it. I fucking hope so, because I am ready to move on.
Because, I mean, they're just so specific. Like, they're not just so specific. They're too specific to just claim that it's part of the world building.
I think so. Jess, I'm just about like out. I am like I am tapped out. Tell me, what do we think?
Are you ready for the next one?
Yeah. Honestly, I've put so much work into this that I want a payoff. You know, it's been a long time. 2019 to 2023 is a long time between books. When you're starting off a series like this, I think personally, but. You know, publishing is difficult and it is what it is. But yeah, I want to read the second one. I want to know a direction of where this is going. And then, you know, if that book is good, we can continue because second books usually are better. So fingers crossed.
Yeah, I'm interested to see while we have the momentum because, I mean, I'm happy I got it from the library. I don't know if I would have been thrilled if I paid out of pocket for this.
Yeah, totally fair. And also, It does go reiterating that the library version of this book is much harder to comprehend than the book that is available. I read this through Audible. So that is also something to consider.
Yeah. And I mean, we have the background now, so it'll be interesting how that, like you said, how it translates. And will I, or we don't know where the story, that's the thing. Like, is it picking up immediately? I mean, we'll find out as this episode is, you know, aired January 2023 and the Hellbent, the book two comes out this month as well. So, thanks for joining us. Feel free to follow us on Instagram, ACAFE Podcast. We're also both on TikTok, ACAFE Laura and ACAFE Jessica. And feel free to read us a 5-star review if you ever, well, we'd appreciate it, you know, on any of your listening platforms. So thanks so much. We'll talk to y'all soon. Bye.
Bye.